Joining me today on The Skeptical Eye from Canada is Alex Smith, host of Radio EcoShock, the airwaves' premier program on climate change, environmental, and energy issues. Radio EcoShock is now in its eighth year on the air. Alex's show, which airs weekly on more than 70 college, community, and commercial radio stations, is available as a podcast and for MP3 downloads. Alex has worked previously as a researcher for a global environmental group, as a print journalist, and as a private investigator. And on his website, or his Facebook, I believe he says that he's also a world traveler. And I want to give our listeners an idea of what one can hear on Radio EcoShock, and as an example, some recent programs that Alex Smith has presented. Here's some examples. El Nino Storms the World, What to Do While Waiting for the Crash, Permaculture Toward a Future, A Climate Beyond Imagination, Religion Versus Climate Science, Climate Change Has Arrived, Climate Dark Age, America Fukushima. So a little bit of everything. And if I've been listening to Alex since about 2006, and I can't think of too many things that deal with environmental, energy issues, climate change. I think he has covered just about every topic. And with that, Alex Smith from Radio EcoShock, thank you so much for joining us down here in the States, here in mid-Missouri. Thanks for being here with me on KOPN.
Well, thanks for the chance to talk with you and with your listeners. I'd say about 75% of Radio EcoShock listeners are in the United States, and it ranges from the deep south right up to the north, and especially, of course, California and the Pacific Western states. So, I keep in touch with what's happening in the United States for sure. I've lived there for a few years now and then, so I feel like I've got a handle on America. Love the place.
Give our listeners some idea, and I'm actually curious about this, too. Was I right in saying that your show is about 8 years old now? It seemed to me it was sometime around 2006 when I first discovered it.
Yeah, first broadcast was in September 2006. My first guest was the famous songwriter Terry Jacks, you know, Seasons
yes.
in the Sun, and he's won a bunch of different awards for his songs. So I was a little nervous interviewing Terry, but he was good to me, and since then I've talked to a lot of musicians, but mostly scientists and authors and experts in different fields.
And I'm curious about how you found yourself getting into doing radio, and particularly programming that deals with things like climate change and other environmental issues. You say on your Facebook, I believe, that you had worked previously for a global environment group. Matt, could you give our listeners some idea? How did you spend your decades before you actually got into radio?
Well, I was a part-time farmer and back to the lander in the late 70s, early 80s. We lived for 10 years without electricity there and raised most of our own food and some pigs and chickens and that sort of thing. And then went to Vancouver. Both my wife and I started working for nonprofits, and especially in the environment. And I started up a news service for environmental groups that covered the whole world and ran into global warming about 1990. So I was 2 years after James Hansen had told Congress about it, but I was still pretty early on it. Followed it ever since, and kind of retired again around 2004, and thought I'd just sort of live my own little private life, but I couldn't keep quiet about what I could see coming down the pike with this climate change. It's going to change all of our lives and make some of us more miserable than we've been. So I decided to interview the people who really knew about it and get the word out there, and it's grown very slowly. I started with just one radio station and then picked up some more and some more and some more, and a lot of people download it, as you said, and get the podcast, and now we've got a SoundCloud page, so some people just search for Radio EcoShock on that. Yeah.
In fact, I think your show is unique because I follow these science podcasts now, and I look for this type of programming when I'm on the internet because I'm curious who is doing this sort of thing out there, and I'm always interested in hearing people that are doing interviews with people like James Hansen and some of these other great features. And I'm not really aware of any other science radio program or podcast that seems to cover this particular topic, the environment and climate, like you do. It continues to be a really unique program. And it goes all the way back to 2006. Am I correct in saying that your program might have been one of the first in this era of podcasting and MP3 that actually did something like this?
I think it may be. There have been green radio programs before me. Earthbeat was one, and Eco Talk on Air America.
Yes, right.
You know, they were ahead of me, but weren't doing podcasting. So to get it out in the different media, I may have been the first to do that. And certainly I've concentrated more on climate science, I think, than anybody.
I can't find another program that concentrates on all this as much as you do. So it is a really unique thing. And, of course, I believe I told you in one of my emails, I'm also trying now to be one of your next stations that actually broadcast your program, because I think it would be a great addition to our progressive community here in central Missouri. So your program is indeed unique. Can you tell us?
I have a show. I have a show that might interest your Missouri listeners coming up. I'm just working, doing the research now. I spend a lot of time. I'll spend sometimes a month, 2 months, just researching a particular program. This one's on gardening in the heat, and it has two aspects. One is how to keep your plants alive when it's over 100 degrees and it's hot, and the second is how to keep yourself alive when you got to be out there gardening and the heat beating. Tips. So I'm doing the work on it, and I think that'll be out sometime in June. So that, keep your ear out for that.
We will definitely anxiously await that. I guarantee you that particular topic will be a hit here in central Missouri, and particularly for our KOPN community. Yeah, how do you go about choosing the subjects of your program?
Well, I used to be a news junkie, as I say, and collected it electronically, and I still do a lot of that. But I also get a lot of suggestions from listeners, and I value those highly. They'll say, well, you should have so-and-so, and why don't you cover this? And in fact, the heat, Gardening in the Heat program, a person wrote me from southern Florida saying, I'm having trouble keeping my vegetables alive, and it's only going to get worse as the climate warms. What am I going to do? So that's the kind of good tip I get from listeners. But again, I watch the news stories, and I have a sort of science alert service that sends me press releases before they're released to the rest of the media or before the public would hear of them. And so that keeps me on top of what's coming out in new science.
You've probably talked to more experts in the field of climate change than in any other on-air personality that I'm aware of at this point. And I'm kind of curious, after the 8 years of listening to all of these major names in the field that are concerned about what's going on with our environment and the climate, where are you standing right now? Well, what do you feel right now about what's going on, about what the human condition is at this point, and what might or might not be happening?
Well, there are some doomsayers who say that humans are just going to go extinct, and I don't agree with that at all. We're tough and we're resourceful.
James Lovelock, for instance.
Well, James Lovelock, but Guy McPherson's another one. If people are interested,
yes,
they can look for his blog, Nature Bats Last, and look at his arguments. But I feel we're headed for a changed world. But humans can adapt to a changed world, I think. We did adapt to the great ice ages. But it's not going to be the world that we pictured, where society runs along as normal and you go to university and then you get a good job and you keep that job for a long time. And I don't see that happening. It's going to be a slow progression. Some people are impatient. It's almost like waiting for Jesus to appear in your lifetime. They want to see some earth-shaking event happen in their lifetime that'll wake everybody up. I don't think that's going to happen. I think people are just going to become slowly more aware that their world is changing around them. The biggest news, and what I covered in last week's show, I'd say this is the biggest news in the last 2 years.
Already, I'll bet I know what you're going to say. Go ahead.
Yeah. It's Antarctica.
Yes. That was my next question.
We all thought, you know, it's actually a little colder there than it was because of the way the winds have tightened up. Our northern jet stream has loosened up because the Arctic has heated up so much. There's not much difference between the Arctic and the equator as there used to be. And that's why you see these giant waves of the jet stream that throw you into a weather pattern that can last for a month, where it rains for a month and then there's a drought for a month, you know, depending on which side of the jet stream you're on. But in Antarctica, the polar winds have tightened around the continent there. So we thought, okay, it's not going to melt. And there's so much ice on land there that if it does melt, our sea levels will go up more than 70 feet. And you think about that for a minute, you know, no more New York City,
it's,
no more Shanghai, and so on. Gone. But now NASA has come out with a study, and there was another one from the University of Washington, just from observations, saying that, yes, the Antarctic glaciers, at least some of them on the western side of Antarctica, are melting. And just the glaciers that they studied alone, it's just a small part of that continent, will bring up the sea level by 4 feet, by about 2100, maybe 2150. So a baby being born today has a good chance of seeing sea levels 4 feet higher. Now, 4 feet higher, that's globally. It will actually go up more in some places because the sea is not level. And you get storm surges like we saw in Katrina for New Orleans that take it, you know, as much as 10 or 20 feet above that. And that's what happened with Hurricane Sandy, too. You had the big storm surge. So, you know, we're going into a changed world where a child born today, you know, when I look at a map, for example, and I see an old map, it had the Soviet Union, and we thought that could never change, but now there's Russia and a bunch of little countries. But when that child born today looks at a map, a great part of Florida won't be there.
It's so hard to imagine. It's just an unimaginable thing. What jumped out at me from the NASA study was when I heard with my own ears, this is the, was he from the University of California? But it's one of the two papers that came out on this. The term that was used was the eventual loss of a major section of this West Antarctic ice sheet appears unstoppable. That was from NASA. That caught my attention immediately. I said, now this is something. It appears unstoppable. It's going to happen no matter what we do, is what he said, I believe. That was important news.
Yeah, and usually a government agency and all scientists are very cautious. They'll say, well, this may happen, or we think there's a 70% chance of something. No, he said it's unstoppable, and he went into, in the teleconference that I broadcast, he went into the mechanics that really involve not so much the heat in the air, but the heat in the oceans that are undermining those glaciers and causing them to move out. And it's gone so far now that he's pretty sure, and the whole team there is pretty sure, that they will melt, and we will see that sea level rise. It's going to take time. There'll be, you know, a couple of inches here and there and a couple inches here and there, but it will happen.
How much do you think the scientists behind these two studies, and especially the NASA people, how much do you think they owe to what James Hansen went through when he was trying back in the Bush days to tell the truth about what he thought was going on? Do you think these new scientists really owe him in particular a debt of gratitude because he actually stuck to his guns and went through one heck of a lot of trouble for speaking the truth?
The Bush administration tried to muzzle him and say, well, you can only speak when we tell you to, and we'll tell you what you can say. And I'm sad to say that that's exactly what's happening to government climate scientists here in Canada. They've been told that, you know, supposing I want to talk to a Canadian scientist, and we've got some good ones, I phone them up. Well, they have to check with the Prime Minister's office. It's like calling the president to see whether it's all right to talk. And then some young guy that knows nothing about climate will send them back an email telling them what they can say.
Exactly.
So, you know, this kind of repression is still going on. It's happening now in Australia, where a sort of right-wing government has come in, and he's a total climate denier, Prime Minister Abbott there. And he wants to cut the funding and all the good work that's been done. And Australia has been hit harder almost than anybody, maybe other than the United States, with climate change. They've had fires. 2013 was the hottest year they've ever experienced. Huge drought, cities running out of water. Perth, Australia, they have to build a new $4 billion desalinization plant because they don't have enough water to keep the city going because of this drought, and it looks like the drought will last hundreds of years, as will the drought in the U.S. Southwest. I mean, it's sad to see these governments that get money from big coal and big oil when it comes time to do their political campaigns. And they make promises and they keep them, and the climate scientists get shut down.
If you have just tuned in, you are listening to The Skeptical Eye. I'm your host, John Betts, and with me from all the way up in Canada is Alex Smith, host of Radio Eco Shock. And it's great to have you with me here, Alex. After having listened to probably about 100 or more maybe of your great programs, it's great to have you have the opportunity to get your voice out here in central Missouri on a subject that I guarantee you there is a very large community here in central Missouri that understands all too well the importance of what you are doing. Am I correct, Alex, also in thinking that although, as these NASA scientists are saying, it might be the end of this century, or it might be more than 100 years, even 200 years before the loss of these Antarctic ice sheets actually causes some of these horror stories that you've been talking about. But is it not also true what many of us do not understand? It isn't like at a certain point, 100 years from now, all of these things happen. We will have all kinds of horrendous events going on slowly, and then more and more and more of them. And those of us alive now most certainly can be experiencing some of these horrible storms and droughts. It's just that the real disaster might be 100 years or 200 years from now, but we're all going to be feeling the effects of these things. Is that not true?
Oh, absolutely. We're being impacted by climate change right now. This is where these extreme storms are coming from. We just had a case in Bosnia where that part of Eastern Europe got 3 months' worth of rain in 3 days. And there were many deaths and billions of dollars of damage. People had to be evacuated from their cities and villages. And these extreme rainfall events are happening around the world. We can just tick them off on a calendar. Practically every 2 weeks there's some place gets absolutely record rain. And that is climate related, because the atmosphere, as it warms, can hold more water vapor. And so there's more up there to come down. And there are other factors, some of which involve pollution as well, that cause these extreme rainfall events. And then you have Texas. Look at Texas. That's the cattle state. Well, it isn't now, because about 2 years ago, they had to sell off so many of the herds of cattle because the drought just went on and on and on. Now, they may get some relief this winter because we're going into a period called El Nino, which is a different weather system, which tends to bring more moisture to California, but also right across the whole south. It's predicted this winter and next spring will be wetter, should be in Missouri, if things work out the way the scientists think they will, and then but drier to the north. So up in Nebraska and the Corn Belt, they're going to have some troubles as far as getting enough moisture for their crops. So these are big changes that are happening now in just so many ways. The wildfires, very intense wildfires happening. I could go on for hours, and I do in the radio show. But I want to point out that in addition to these disasters, and there's almost a good thing coming out of this, which is more people are aware that the system they live in is fragile and under attack. And so they want to grow their own food, and they want to find out how to produce more of the things that they need locally and get more of a local economy going. And I cover that in the show as well. Things like permaculture, local currencies, what can people in areas of high unemployment do to get green jobs going. There's a lot that can happen, and there's some wonderful examples happening all around the U.S. and in England, Australia, and Canada to follow. And so I cover that too.
Isn't there a danger from, I'm thinking of bugs right now, with these horrible conditions, are we going to be developing more and more and more? Even our bugs can probably at some point start evolving into some sort of super bug to make things even worse. I'm pretty sure you may have had a program on that. It sticks in my mind.
Yes, I've talked to the bug experts, the entomologists, and there's several things to watch for. There's some existing bug-borne diseases like dengue fever, which is now in southern Florida and southern Texas. And as you know, the whole crop growing seasons that are issued by the USDA is moving northward. You know, you have these crop zones. Well, with that, the insect zones move further northward as well. So we will see some tropical diseases. We've already got the Nile fever, which is a tropical disease, but it's even into Canada, and it's all across the U.S., mosquito-borne disease. So we're going to see more of that. But there are other serious health effects just from heat. A lot of people die from heat, and in fact, heat is the number one killer of people in Australia now, not traffic accidents, not even lung cancer, but heat. So when you think about that, but we can do things about that. There's a lot of smart ways to have our houses, to rearrange our lives, to rearrange our working, you know, work in the morning, work in the evening, and don't try and work right through the day on that paving job just because it's 9 to 5. It can kill you. So,
right.
You know, we've got to get a little bit smarter in a hotter world, and I think we can handle the heat death aspect of it. But as far as the bugs go, I don't know what we'll do about it.
Is it not also possible that climate at some point can wind up being a major factor in what happens to the world's financial markets? It's bound
Absolutely.
To have an absolute incredible effect.
It happens in two ways. One of them is, once people realize that burning coal and oil and gas is what's doing this, and that it is wrecking our world and even wrecking our grandchildren's world worse, people will come to this realization. And then there will be a demand to move away from them. And we can do it quickly, as we did in World War II. In World War II, the government said to the car companies, you're not going to make any more cars. You're going to make airplane parts. You're going to make parts for our ships and tanks. And so, you know, car production stopped in 1942, and it was a big part of the American economy even then. We've got plenty of cars. We've got all we ever need. So if we converted those plants over into making solar panels and wind machines, in just a few years, we could make a big change. So, but what happens is the world economy is heavily, heavily invested in gas and oil companies. Your pension plan, if you have one,
yes.
People's investments in banks, they're all totally into that. And there have been reports. There's one called Unburnable Carbon, which people should look up. It's from carbontracker.org, and it looked at the financial ramifications of switching away from gas and oil and coal, and they are gigantic. So that's one problem. But the other is, how long can we afford to rebuild? We can't really afford to spend another $60 billion on the next Hurricane Sandy and put the same houses and businesses back where they were. We're going to have to withdraw from the coast there. Or we'll build giant berms and we'll try and protect the port of New York for another $10 billion. And we'll eventually, climate change wears the economy down to the point where I think it will collapse. And at that point, you want to have a local economy. You want to have local food. You want to know where your food shed is, as they say, what all your resources are, who the people are involved. Keep those skills alive. Keep your local farmers alive for sure. And that involves some municipal planning and some county planning and some state planning to make it happen, but it can happen.
Dr. Peter Ward has always been adamant that probably the greatest danger that we have now associated with power production are the coal-powered plants. And one of his big fears is that we have these billions of Chinese and Indians now who want the same standard of living as Americans have. They want a car in every garage, and that they are producing coal-powered plants. I've heard that as many as maybe two or three coal-powered plants are going online every week. And I find that to be a terrifying thought, if that is indeed true. And it's just going to make all of this climate change escalate even quicker, isn't it, if this is indeed what is going on? These billions of people that want one or two cars just like we do, they want exactly the kind of life that we have here in the United States. It presents a kind of frightening scenario for us, doesn't it?
It does. It scared the pants off me when the pictures of thousands and thousands of people bicycling to work in Shanghai changed to cars, and not just any cars. They bought Buicks. They love Buicks. It's a big family car. And I thought, oh, no, we are going down the tubes with this. But there is sort of some good news and some bad news going on the coal front. In America, coal power generation has fallen. It was about 50%. Now it's down to 41%. No new coal plants are being built in the United States that I know of, and they're unlikely to be built any time in the future. And this is why people like Warren Buffett's company and the people like the Koch brothers want to push coal exports to Asia, because that's where the market is, China and to a certain degree India. And coal production is really ramping up in Australia, for example. They're going to build gigantic ports and just mine the heck out of the earth, and they're being hit hard by climate change. This is the weird thing, is that even while we're suffering, we continue to do the same thing. It's like any addict, you know. They know that crack cocaine is killing them, but they got to go out and get another hit. And that's where we are with coal right now. We know it's going to kill us, but we just seem to need the electricity more than we need to think about our children. So I don't know exactly how that's going to go. China also has a gigantic market for solar and wind. They've got more solar and wind than the United States does now. So they're not totally oblivious to this problem. They would love to be off of coal. It's something they have to pay other countries for, and they would rather produce their energy at home if they could. So, you know, I'm not sure exactly how that's going to go. We may see a fairly rapid drop-off in coal production. That will be one of the first things to go as people wake up and say, no, I want a safe climate.
I'm John Betts, and you are listening to The Skeptical Eye, the program that looks at science, pseudoscience, and that twilight zone that may or may not exist in between. And my guest today is Alex Smith, who's talking with me from up in Canada, beautiful Canada. And he is the host of Radio Eco Shock, which is aired on about over 70 community, college, and commercial radio stations here in the United States. Alex also has a gigantic library after 8 years of podcasts that can be downloaded as MP3s. And Alex has joined me today to talk about the subject of climate change and energy issues. And once again, Alex, thank you so much for being able to find time for me in what I know is an extremely busy schedule.
It is busy, but you know, I have a place in my heart for small community radio. That's how I got going, and I think that you hear things on community radio that you don't hear on the commercial stations. They're going to tell you about Kim Kardashian and all the latest scandals, but they're not going to tell you how to garden in the heat and how to, you know, keep a good future for your kids. And it's too bad. They need to be talking about that. They're not yet. Maybe someday.
Absolutely. Well, you know, Alex, KOPN is the sixth oldest remaining on the air community radio station in the United States, and we were the first outside of the Pacifica network. So we were the first one to serve a population of under 100,000 people, and it's something that we're really proud of here in this community. We're now celebrating our, 41st year. So we've been going for a long time, and it's always a challenge, as you know, trying to keep a community radio station on the air. Money is always a factor, which I know you know about that. So it's particularly great to have you speaking to our audience here at Community Radio in Mid-Missouri. I want to ask you a little bit about solar now, since you brought that up. And here's a question that I have. Last summer, out in Hawaii at the station where they measure the place, that high spot on Mauna Loa, they measured the CO2 at 400. It finally hit 400. And unless he has changed his views, I know James Hansen and his colleagues at NASA, his former colleagues at NASA, I believe he's retired now from NASA, they came up with the number of 450 parts per million as being the tipping point. And Hansen using that PETM extinction 55 million years ago. At that time, I think there was about 1,400 parts per million CO2 in the atmosphere, and there was no ice. There was no ice anywhere on Earth, and there was none until about 30 million years ago when the CO2 dropped below 450. So we have hit 400 now officially. Hansen and his people think that somewhere around 450 is maybe the tipping point where who knows what the human race would have to do. That is kind of frightening to me. And so on the subject of solar, do you think it would be better to rather, I mean, it's great. My wife and I are now considering going solar here very shortly to join the group of others here in central Missouri that have done it. But would it be better to try to maybe come up with some sort of a national program where you would have, rather than individual homes, you could do it for individual blocks or neighborhoods, even if you had trouble getting the entire city to do it? Would that be a better approach? Should that be what we're striving to do?
I think it would be a better approach, but the problem is the national governments, and not just in the United States, but in many countries, are almost non-functional. They serve the lobbies of the large corporations. They fight with these sort of fake, I'm Democrat, you're Republican, we can never talk thing. And so many things, good things, get stalled that I don't have a lot of faith in national action. I do have some faith in state action. We've seen some good state action in various states. And certainly localities and cities. There have been some green mayors in different cities that have really brought out some good points. So I think it's going to be a smaller thing. And this is the beautiful thing about solar. You know, with a coal plant or any other big electric generation project, you have to spend billions and you have to have a great big grid to do it. With solar, you can do it for your house and you're the grid, or you can do it for your block, as you suggested, a great idea. You have a block-wide grid or you know, a small area. So it's a distributed power system. And the beauty of that is we lose half of all the power we generate just in the transmission lines.
Right.
So we could cut our power use in half by removing those transmission lines and generating power where you need it, which, it turns out, is in your house or in your factory. I mean, they built a whole solar-powered car factory in Spain. They just put solar panels on the roof of this giant place where they were making cars, and it turned out to be enough to run the plant. So, you know, we can do it on a small scale and avoid those transmission losses. They're talking right now about whether to build, you know, a super transmission system, a new grid for the United States. It would be a good thing, especially if you're going to have wind power in Texas and you need it in Missouri. But we can sort of, if that doesn't work, we can still go with solar and make something work.
Does the 400 part per million give you pause on whether or not there's a time factor here? Is there time for us to do all that? Do you still feel comfortable that if we could just get a movement going, that the human race still has time to slow this inevitable end down with only 50 parts per million to go?
Well, you know, the last great extinction was 55 million years ago, and the big one was 250 million years ago, and at that point, everything but about 10% of all life on the planet,
right,
on both the oceans and the land,
the
was
Permian,
exterminated.
The Permian extinction.
Yeah, and you can find strips of rock that are 10 million years deep that have practically nothing in it, no signs of leaves, no signs of anything, no fossils. And the really strange thing is, except for the one 55 million years ago where a comet, we think, hit us in the Gulf of Mexico and wiped out most of the dinosaurs very quickly, the other mass extinctions did happen due to climate change, but it happened very slowly. It took thousands of years for that to develop. Now we're doing it in a couple hundred years, and so that's the real X factor. We don't know, you know, there's no time for anything to evolve. Evolution takes a long time, many generations. So the plants and the animals and ourselves, we're not going to evolve in time to handle a wholly different climate. So that's a real problem. I don't feel comfortable about our chances. I feel nervous. But I do feel we still have a chance because of that example I gave you of World War II and of other examples.
Right, exactly.
Where humans have rallied pretty quickly when their backs are up against the wall. And I guess that's what we're waiting for, is for our backs to be against the wall, where it's so miserable. We've got these new diseases. The food prices double and triple. Energy prices go through the roof. We just can't seem to make it anymore. And then we say to our politicians, or to our whole political system and our banking system, this isn't working for us. We want to do something different. And then we'll see how many years we have to make a change. The other thing about it is, though, is we can all use a lot less electricity. I lived for 10 years without electricity, and I know that it can be done. Now, I did have coal oil lamps, and then eventually we got a propane fridge, which was wonderful. But we can live on a tiny amount of electricity, just what we get off solar panels off our roof, if we really set our minds to it. And people are already doing that in India and other places where they have just a couple of solar panels. It's enough to charge up their cell phones, maybe run a TV for the news, and keep some lights on so their kids can do their homework at night. That's all they want, and that's all they really need.
What are your feelings about James Lovelock? And who our listeners, if our listeners are not familiar with the name, he is called the father of Gaia, the Gaia theory, Mother Earth. And he is a scientist, a great, I consider him a great scientist. This is the man who invented the electron capture device. He was one of the people who was responsible for discovering the chlorofluorocarbons in the atmosphere. He's a great scientist, and of course his Gaia theory is all about the Earth being a self-regulating system that makes the Earth a place where life can exist. And he, in the past, though, he has been kind of a doomsdayer on the human race's chances of stopping this thing. And he's fascinating to read, and I always find myself saying, God, he sounds so believable. And at the same time, I want to say, but it can't be too late for the human race. We've got to be able to do something. What are your thoughts on James Lovelock?
He's one of these geniuses who is either very right or very wrong. And he's got a history of that. I mean, you
yes, he
CFCs.
Does.
Yes. It was his device that allowed us to measure CFCs right. in the atmosphere. But then he spoke on behalf of the chemical companies telling
exactly.
Congress that CFCs were perfectly safe.
He did indeed.
So, and instead they helped create the ozone hole, which has threatened us all. So, you know, and I must say, too, that he's 90-something now.
Yeah, he's about 95 now.
Yeah. Well, since about the age of 85, I would say, he's become more erratic in some of the things that he says. I appreciate that he's willing to show humans how bad it could be, and maybe it could be that bad. I mean, he said we'd end up with just a few breeding pairs of humans around the Arctic Ocean, which would be tropical. And incidentally, the Arctic Ocean has been kind of tropical in the past. They found crocodiles.
Crocodiles in the up around the Arctic Circle.
Yeah, on Ellesmere Island, part of Canada, around the Arctic Circle. So it has happened in the past. But I really doubt some of the other statements that he's made in later years, and I'm not alone in that. He's become just a little bit more
yeah, that's
erratic.
True.
We need people like James Lovelock to shake us out of our shells and make us think, but I'm not sure I believe everything that he says.
He's someone whose writing and work I've followed since I was in college, and I really enjoy reading his work immensely, and I come away with similar feelings. I can't quite convince myself what it is I feel about his pronouncements, but he is. Many people consider him a genuine genius. He has done some incredible things. On the subject of nuclear power, what went wrong? What happened with nuclear? Was it a fantasy from the first that never had a chance to really be what the human race needed to solve our energy problems?
You know, nuclear power would work if it wasn't humans doing it. It's not that so much that it's necessarily flawed, although it may be, but we are definitely flawed. And so when you go on these great projects to construct a nuclear plant, you do have some construction people who want to make an extra buck by leaving the rebar out of the concrete, who just plain cheat and show you x-rays that it's in there when it isn't. I mean, this is historical fact. This has happened. And so then you get into a culture, you've got to run these things for 40 years. And during that time, people fall asleep, and you can save a million or $100 million by not replacing that control panel or those pumps over there. And of course, they're corporations. They got to make a profit. So we do it, and we don't do the maintenance, and we don't have perfect people to run them. And so I think it's just there's so much risk to that technology. It's not a good one for humans to have. And you could say the same thing about nuclear weapons. I mean, nuclear weapons are not good for humans to have because we get all angry and start wars, and we want to use them if we've got them in. So the same thing goes with nuclear power. Now, we've just had that gigantic disaster in Japan, the three nuclear plants melting right down into the ground at Fukushima. And for a while there, it was touch and go whether Japan would remain habitable. Parts of Tokyo were so irradiated that people left Tokyo and are still leaving Tokyo and should, because that will last for hundreds of years, the radiation that both came there in their rainwater and ran downstream from there and came by in the ocean. There were many ways that it got to Tokyo. So do we really want to take that chance that part of eastern, the southeastern states will be uninhabitable, as it is in Ukraine around the Chernobyl accident? Is it really that important to have your electricity and be able to run your toasters 24 hours a day or whatever, that we're willing to take that chance for our kids, that this stuff lasts, plutonium lasts 500,000 years. And some of the plutonium from the Fukushima reactor was carried by the winds over the United States and landed on the western states in particular, as well as uranium and some other radioactive materials. That stuff will be there when my grandchild has his grandchild, and more cancers will come from it, more health problems will come from it. It's just not worth it. We can't take those chances.
Before I have to let you go, I wanted to hear your thoughts on the subject of the popularization of science. And as an example of someone who I think does a fantastic job on trying to interest the general reader in subjects like climate change and what has happened in the Earth's history in the past because of things like climate change is Dr. Peter Ward, that I've mentioned a number of times. And I think that he has written at least 7 or 8 books now that are meant for the general reader over about the last 20 years. And he was a major force for me in getting my interest, the interest that I have now in climate change, in introducing me to all this. And I found it to be, his books to be very valuable. What do you think the importance is of trying to have a population who may have nothing in their professional life or their working life has anything to do with science, but these popularizers have the potential to stimulate their imagination and their minds and to get them interested? How important is it to popularize this subject?
Well, of course, I'm doing it, so I think it's really important. We do have this tool now that can tell us a lot about our present, our past, and our future. No previous generation of humans have had such a powerful tool at their disposal. Now, we have a part of the population who turns away from that tool and says, no, the only tool that I need is the Bible. And I don't think they're incompatible, incidentally, and there are a lot of Christians who agree with me on that. We've had them on the show. Reverend Dowd, for example,
yes,
is a recent guest.
Right.
So we don't have to deny science to have other beliefs about our spiritual lives. So it starts in school, and if you're a parent, please support your science teacher and your science program and your math teacher and your math program. They're not glorious like the football program, but they are absolutely essential to our future and that our kids get that. And it's not too late for you and me. I learn a lot by watching lectures on YouTube. Anybody can do that. You can look up climate change. You can look up all sorts of different things about science and find free lectures from all around the world. And you'll find out that some of the best ones only have 46 views.
You know? Yes.
it's not like you're looking for a popularity contest. You're looking for people who speak to you and wake your brain up and educate you on a level you can understand. I found it interesting. You know, I'm in a fantastic position. I talk with some of the best scientists around the world. I feel so privileged. But part of my secret is I give them time to talk. I'm not looking for sound bites. I want them to get going. And I know that they're people on a level, and I ask them personally how they feel about the work they're doing. And I try and get them to relate to all of our listeners in the radio land in ways that this science could really apply to their lives. So I ask them those kinds of questions. Well, what does this mean for our weather next year? Well, what does this mean for gardening? What does this mean for our health? And that way, we can get this out and get people interested so they can follow up. But school is never over. If you think you're through with school, I don't care what your level of literacy is. YouTube, you don't need to be able to read a lot. Everybody's got to go back to school because the world is totally changing. And there's things we never knew that I never knew until 2 weeks ago that I'm finding out.
Your program is being heard on at least 75 stations here in the United States and, I guess, in Canada, around a number of other countries. And I see this sort of thing as being evidence that people from the general population who maybe did not spend their in working career in science, people who are interested in these subjects, do have the potential and the ability to draw in other people from the general population just like them and to educate them and to get them interested in all this. I find that to be a great hope for the future. It makes me feel like we can overcome these problems. But a show like yours, I think, does more good than most universities have recognized. They should be aware of what other programs can do, and the public can be reached. Maybe it doesn't have to be through the experts at the top.
Well, nonprofit radio does a lot of that. Your radio station does a lot of that. And then if listeners can build on that by taking, say, this interview as a download, can they get it as a download?
Yes,
after
they
the
can.
Program?
Our programs are podcasted here at KOPN.
All right. Then share that through social media, through the Facebook page, through Twitter, and with your family if you're brave enough. I know some don't want to hear it, but some should. If everybody becomes their own little broadcasting station from what they hear through your station and through my program, then it'll get out there. And the faster we do that, the less pain we're going to have in the future, and the happier our descendants will be. We don't want to be known as the generation that wrecked the house. We want to be known as the generation that saved the house.
And I believe on that high point, it's probably a good time to say, Alex Smith, how much I appreciate your finding the time to spend this last hour with me here at KOPN. And I want to wish you and Radio EcoShock continuing success in the future. I think you have done some tremendous things over the last 8 years, and I still say I am not aware of any other radio program anywhere that has spent as much time as you have on this particular subject. And I you've helped make some changes, and you've helped give us all a lot of hope for the future, and good luck in the future. And I would love to have you back here with me one of these days and to talk a little more about what you think is happening.
Well, thanks for giving me the opportunity to connect with KPON listeners. It's been real, and I've enjoyed talking with you. And, yes, let's talk again.
Okay. All the luck in the world, Alex.